Hello, and welcome to another episode of Healthy Minds. I'm Julie, your host. This episode is part of our series called Black Mental Health Matters. We're covering different aspects of systemic racism and their impact on mental wellness. I have a special guest joining me today. Her name is Kimberly Humphrey, and she is a federal and state legislative affairs expert with over a decade of experience. She's an attorney by trade and activist at heart, committed to unlocking opportunity in workplaces and public policy spaces. She works with government and organizational leaders to ensure that policies have a positive, practical impact on every person. Her commitment to representation and elevating marginalized voices, especially those of historically underserved Black Americans, has opened doors to deeper community influence and lasting systemic change. Great. Her work experience ranges from human resources policy development to civil rights advocacy. In 2017, she served on the Maryland Commission on the School-to-Prison Pipeline and Restorative Practices, an advisory body that studied the impact of police in schools and recommended culture-defining changes for school leaders and law enforcement. She also advocated for and won a distinct racial equity review of Maryland's long-awaited public education funding formula recommendations. Kimberly is a sought-after strategist who has presented at numerous conferences, panels, legislative briefings, including before the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights, and now she's joining us on this humble podcast to talk a little bit about racism and representation in the workplace. So hi, and welcome.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
I'm very excited, especially about the restorative practices piece. I actually did some work very easily with restorative practices model in Howard County with the Homewood School.
Wonderful.
Yeah, so it's kind of cool to see you out there in the in the wild, so to speak, and then bring it right back in. It's funny how connected we all are. So we're talking about racism and representation in the workplace today, and I'm really curious to hear what you think maybe is the most glaring example of racism in the workplace.
Sure. I think that first, when we talk about racism and mental health, I just think it's important to clarify what racism is. Oftentimes in our common lexicon, racism is kind of misunderstood. A lot of people tend to think of racism as an interpersonal hate, right? But it's important to understand that racism is a system, right? So it's defined as a system of advantage and oppression that is based on race. And I really thought it was important to, you know, just clarify that, because when we think about that, it helps us understand the layers of racism in our society. Of course, the workplace being one of them and the place where I find that it's often most glaring, but it takes it out of just that interpersonal, you know, I'm not racist, I didn't harm you, so what are all the complaints and the discussion that are still happening for something that happened, you know, centuries ago? So I hope that's helpful for everyone. I think it's just important to couch my comments in that. And I think the example that I want to talk about, which is pay equity, really highlights some of those issues too. So maybe the easiest way to explain the pay equity issue is the disparity that we see based on research. And, you know, I think the latest movement of Time's Up, the movement that happened in Hollywood, really highlights the issues that we see with pay equity or pay inequity. So it's when people basically do not get the same pay for equal work. And unfortunately, we see that this happens along the lines of race, but, you know, gender, disability, a lot of other categories. And this just essentially seems to be based on normed practices of oppression or advantage for one over another, because it's often just based on, you know, the history of what we've defined as more valuable, which insights whose work is more valuable. And so traditionally, just to give context, you know, white males kind of at the top of the totem pole in our society, again, the system that gives advantages for one over another. And so as other folks enter the workforce and where you have decision makers that, you know, don't always represent everyone, the data shows that unfortunately there are a lot of pay inequities and pay gaps. And so that's one I feel very passionately about. And I hope that, you know, in addition to the climate and the change that we're seeing along the lines of police brutality, that we will also begin to have more conversations about the everyday ways that racism really impacts people across society.
Yeah, thank you so much for giving us the context and explaining kind of what we mean by racism, not just the overt, I don't like you side of things, which of course is very real and happens all the time, but there's a lot more of the, I'm gonna say sneakier things or the covert side of racism. And it's important to acknowledge that our systems are built to benefit the white male, typically, and the further away you get from being a white male, able-bodied, cisgendered, heterosexual person, the more likely you are to experience multiple types of oppression or racism or sexism or whatever ism we're talking about at the moment. And of course, you can be subject to multiple of these.
Yeah, intersectionality, I believe that's the term, really, I think, gained a lot of popularity around the time of the Women's March, where we were just having more conversations about, again, race. You know, a lot of women generally had concerns about, you know, time's up, our president, Donald Trump, and his unfortunate history of abuse of women. But we also, you know, began to have these conversations about intersectionality because we saw Black women wanting to make sure that their voices were also heard and making sure that the movement was recognizing and really lifting up and trying to change the different ways that oppression is experienced.
Yeah. And I know I've seen intersectionality pop up all over my Facebook and Instagram again, which is great, but it also makes me laugh to see like what's trending and, you know, psychology terms and all that stuff kind of popping up. You're like, oh, okay, is this what we're talking about now? Cool. You know, I have some thoughts on this and I'm going to learn more, obviously, as well. I don't know if you have this. I don't want to put you on the spot, but do you have an example or some of the numbers maybe in the equity disparity?
Yes, I do. So recently, the Economic Policy Institute, I want to get the name right, they did a study, basically it was an analysis of the census data that was released. And it showed that from 2017, wages have been stagnant across the board, right? But in that time, men's wages have actually increased, I believe. Let me make sure I get this right. By 1.1%, and women's wages have increased by 7%, which is good news. So the wage gap is narrowing, but when you look at race, you see that the gaps trending through the years are pretty much the same. So that means that Black people and Black women especially have not seen that narrowing. And so, you know, it's an ongoing conversation. It's an ongoing issue that needs to be addressed. But even when we talk about the wage gap, comparing everyone to white males, I found it very interesting that, and it's an example of white supremacy, when the white male is continually the standard. And so you're comparing everyone to his pay. But in 2015, the study showed that Asian Americans were actually the highest paid. So that's an interesting dynamic that we also see even in education when we think about academic achievement gaps. The narrative is always about, you know, the lagging performance of African Americans, and it doesn't talk about the different opportunity gaps, the different resources that are presented at schools. And it really doesn't talk about how Asian Americans are actually outperforming anyone. So that's just another example of the way that culturally and institutionally, I think white supremacy just kind of continues to show up. And we can see that it's really not really based on anything but the norm, right? It's not based on the facts of what's happening.
That's really interesting. So I kind of want to maybe tease out some of the systemic issues that contribute to the pay equity. So typically it's not going to be as overt as like you know, this person is Black, so we're going to pay them less, right? There's a lot of stuff going on under the iceberg, I guess. You mentioned being under-resourced, right? Education divides, I'm assuming, play into this. What else would you say plays into this?
Well, in the work context, I definitely believe it's just a matter of cultural norms. And that's why I think it's really important to have conversations like this so that it'll start to be on people's radar. When we talk about hiring practices, right? There was a study years ago, and you know, I think partially I'll mention this so that people can actually go and look it up, because I think that's a large part of the work that we will all have to do as we combat racism, is really dig in and look things up for ourselves. But there was a study years ago done on resumes, right? And so they found that you could have the same resume, exactly same set of experiences, same schools listed, but they just changed the names. And so when you had that same resume, but you put a name that was more ethnic sounding or African American sounding, they found that it was less likely to get an interview. So that's just one example of the ways that systemically and in practice and in norms that we continue to kind of disadvantage some people. And there's a number of things that go into that, right? People may just have a certain familiarity. And so they tend to go with things that are familiar, whether it be schools or, you know, geography. But we know that also race is often tied to a lot of those things. Me, for example, I went to an HBCU, Spelman College. So, you know, some people have negative views of HBCUs. So it could be that, or it could just be that they're unfamiliar with it. So I might be less likely to get an interview from that hiring manager. A way that we can combat this though, and I hope I'm not jumping too far ahead, but I do want to just mention that there are different strategies in place. And this deals with not just the hiring practice, but all levels of really training, setting up mentors, and other aspects of ways that you can really incorporate and equalize opportunity. You can, a lot of places, I think they may struggle with this because you often have maybe one person, one HR manager, one person doing all of these interviews. So I've seen, and I've recommended that organizations have committees that they also have. So they have a committee for interviews and for screening of resumes, but also that they have a committee that's reviewing the questions that are asked, so that you see that, you know, sometimes when you're getting different questions, you're not really equalizing the playing field either. And you also want to have tiers of pay grades. And so often we see that, I think the most common, maybe well-known example is in a lot of government jobs, those grades for, or the scale for pay is posted. And I think a lot of organizations could really benefit from making those decisions more transparent. And it's helpful for the people that are applying for work and hoping to have equal opportunity, but it's also a good reminder for those folks who are engaging in the process, who are actually giving offers, to make sure that we're doing it fairly and based on a set of parameters that's applied to everybody.
That is wonderful. We will definitely recap that at the end. I think there's so many issues, right, that we could cover.
Yeah.
I think that transparency in wages is just like the dumbest, easiest thing that we could do. Yeah. I don't know why.
It's yeah.
Time for everybody. Like, I'm not going to apply somewhere that's going to pay me, you know, this amount of money. So why am I going in and sending you a resume and then filling every stupid little blank out? Mm-hmm. And then I get there and I get in the interview and they're finally like, oh, we'll pay you $1 an hour. And you're like, goodbye.
Had I known.
Right.
Oh, I would have spent all this time, you know, going through the process. Sure.
So let's talk about maybe some of these other kind of aspects that pop up in the workplace specifically. So I know that we talked a little bit about the concept of professionalism as being really rooted in like the white experience. To hear a little bit more about that.
Sure. So I think one of the biggest examples of that is an area where I'm really excited that we've seen a lot of progress this year, actually, and over the last few years. And that just has to do with the norms of representation, right? And what is professional? So this, of course, extends beyond just the workplace. And actually, some of the movement that we've seen has to do with professionalism, but it started because of a young man in New Jersey who was participating in a wrestling match and had to cut his locks on the mat during the, I don't know exactly what it's called, during the match. During the match, you know, and he had to make this decision to cut his hair, which was pulled back. He had done many, many matches with that hairstyle the way it was, and here he was at a very pivotal point, and the person made him cut his locks, you know? And he did, the family, and ended up suing. I should have that name, but everyone feel free to do a quick Google search and you'll find it. But this really sparked the conversation for when your natural assets, your hair, your lips, whatever, are judged by the society that you live in, and you can't participate like any other normal citizen. And I think that's really the issue. So when we think about the professional world also, when we think about what is professionalism, often hair has been an issue. There was a case that went either to the appeals or to the Supreme Court about hiring and whether or not an applicant could be required to cut their locks, which is a natural hairstyle. The court upheld it. So the legislators and a lot of states have responded, which they have a right to do, by making hair discrimination illegal. And, you know, that's critical. People want to show up to work and not feel like they have to wear a mask, right? Or, you know, have standards of professionalism that are not linked to your ethnic roots. Or, you know, I think to a certain extent, sometimes there are conversations about what's messy, or, you know, that you do have to have a standard. And that is understandable. And the standard should be fair and apply everyone across the board. But we know that sometimes when you get into conversations about what's messy as terms of hair, you know, I have a little more calm hairstyle than sometimes I usually have. But when I have my natural hair out, it's quite big. And some may say that it's unprofessional, but that's just because of the norms in our society, right? I'm fully capable of doing my job. I'm fully capable of doing my job very well, despite my hair. So I did want to name that the Crown Act is something that's been going around in Maryland. Recently approved a version of it that bans hair discrimination. That's a bill that started in California. And there's just something that's very exciting. It says that, you know, I think it definitely gives Black people the confidence and lets them know, hey, it's okay to be you in the workplace. We see you, we value you, and you're not going to be discriminated on based on race. And, you know, this is exciting. We should be here. You know, it's pretty remarkable that in 2020, we are just now seeing some of these things. And, you know, it is very unfortunate that, you know, 30 years after the Civil Rights Act, almost 40, we're still having to make some of these things law. But progress is good. And even conversations like this are more than welcomed. And, you know, we all, as a society, Black and white and other, you know, must keep pushing.
Yeah, it's just so baffling to me that people are upset about hair and like in all the scheme of things. And, you know, I'm sitting here thinking about the other like hiring discrimination, and it's like sex and religion and then, you know, race. And then now we're in hair. Like, I feel like we've gone totally off the rails because people aren't trusted to be nice human beings, I guess. And I don't know. And I've thought about that a lot, having worked with in a human service field. Mm-hmm. I had a ton of Black coworkers and a ton of, well, and I would say it's probably about a 50-50 split, which was interesting because that's not what we see out in the population. So it was kind of interesting to see this split, but I noticed that a lot of my Black peers were not wearing their natural like hair out, or even if they did braids, they were very short. Like they had very short hairstyles, which I thought was interesting, having gone to school with a ton of people that had, you know,
different styles.
Varying styles, I should say. Mm-hmm. So it was kind of interesting. And I'm reflecting back on this now, and I was like, huh, like everybody had like the same three or four kind of hairstyles, and it must have some sort of conformity to norms, or whether unintentional, right? Some of that might just be, I like this haircut or hairstyle now.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think it is a combination. And it's also a very personal decision, and it should be. And people, I think one thing about the way that this plays out is, you know, under the radar, you know, African Americans are having to make these decisions. If I wear my hair like this to an interview, will I get the job? You know, if I show up, me personally, I worked as a professional lobbyist in Annapolis, which is, it's a very homogenous environment, right? And for a long time, I did just wear my hair straight. It's a style that I still like, but I also like to switch it up. But I hadn't really worn my hair out natural and more like Afro style or twist or, you know, larger style. And so I had to really contemplate and actually talk myself into doing that. And the first few times I was self-conscious. And, you know, that's not because anybody said you can never do that or that's unprofessional, but it's definitely in the messages that we get. And it happens when you have an environment where there's just not as much diversity. And that's why representation is so important. And that's one of the reasons why I started my company, Community Intelligence LLC. It's a consulting firm for public relations and organizational leadership. And I found that when you have communities really invested and involved in the transformation process, you get such better wide-ranging results that are really inclusive. And I think that ultimately to really have the changes that we seek, we need to make inclusivity a regular practice, right? It should be second nature. And when we have any instances where we don't see a lot of diversity, we have to question that immediately, right? You may have someone coming to speak who feels pressure, who's feeling maybe doubt and just not sure they will be received based on the information that they're giving just because of their hair, for example. And so, yeah, that's just, it's just really, it's just a norm, unfortunately. I'm glad that we can have these conversations to make people more aware that this is the impact, you know, of racism, of a society like this. It's not just getting pulled over, it's everyday considerations. Mm-hmm. And I know that often I do want to address that sometimes people may say, well, you know, it's not fair. You know, the society that we live in isn't fair. And people often have to think about a number of things, right? But those considerations really shouldn't fall along the lines of race. You know, I shouldn't have to worry because of something that is so tied to my ethnicity, because, you know, that's unconstitutional. And we've decided that that's not the norm that we want to have in our society. We decided this a long time ago. And it's important that we make that the experience of every American and every, you know, every person that's here in this country.
Yeah, really quickly, because I love that you called out people for Googling and stuff. That's a huge too. I'm always like, go check out this video. Go look at this. Same thing. I encourage you all to Google professional hairstyles and look at the images. I was recently made aware of this. Not something I thought about before. Right, white privilege right here. So if you look, it's just a whole bunch of, you know, white women's hairstyles, basically. I think you have to scroll all the way to the bottom or even get onto page two to find Black hairstyles in there as well. And I did not look at the men, I will be honest. Sorry, but you can do it yourself as a thought experiment. But it's just, it's really eye-opening to see that. And again, it was just a white privilege check there. I was like, huh, I never thought about Googling professional hairstyles, first off. And then, you know, second, to look at what was represented was really interesting. So we've mentioned representation a couple of times. So I want to hop into this topic a little bit. So what do you mean by representation? We'll start there.
Mm-hmm. Sure. So when I talk about representation, I'm talking about one aspect is definitely diversity and having just a range of voices. And I think it's important to recognize that, you know, there's been an important evolution, I believe, in our conversations about diversity. I usually like to say diversity and inclusion, and I'll give you an example. So, you know, there could be someone who's invited to a dance, right? And it's one thing to be invited and then not really, you know, not really acknowledged, which is the case sometimes. That's not going to be a great experience. But it's another thing to be invited and asked to dance, right? And that puts you in a totally different category of feeling a part of that thing. Now, the level that we want everyone to be on, right, I think is to be invited to the party or the dance and be able to dance and be carefree and just have a great time and feel that boldness, that comfort, to know that you can do that freely. And so when I think about representation, I like to use that example in terms of what it means to have a diverse representation, to have actual, not just, you know, symbolic representation, to not just have just one, but to really have people in a space feel included, to value their thoughts, to make sure that it truly is an arena that is comfortable for everyone, you know, where everyone is in the space, carefree, jamming out, having a great time. Another layer to that too is, I think it's kind of helpful to people to just think about is if you invite people somewhere, let's say you have most participants that listen to rock music and you have one that listens to gospel, right? And so you're there, everybody is invited to the space, but the whole night you only play rock music. Is that enjoyable? I don't think so, right? And sometimes people know what they're getting into, but if you're invited somewhere, you would expect there to be a range of music. Or let's say you just have one gospel song, or and then, you know, it's back to rock music. And so I also like to give that example too, because, you know, people that enjoy rock aren't going to notice that, right? But it definitely has a real impact on the way that person who just doesn't listen to rock as much enjoys their time, even though they were welcome to the party, they were invited, and they were in the room.
That is an excellent way to describe that. Thank you for sharing that with us. I have heard.
I have to give a shout out to a colleague of mine who gave me that example. And I was like, that's awesome. Trying to pass it along.
Yeah, no, that was really beautiful. I appreciate that. Because I think a lot of people struggle with, you know, like, well, you're here, so you do something about it, right? Instead of accepting that it's part of the responsibility of leadership and boards and all that kind of stuff to make sure that we're not just like, well, what do you think? And we turn around to the one individual that we have somehow managed to convince to be on board to represent, you know, the population, which is upsetting. And I've seen it many times. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think I'll just add too that in that aspect, just when we think about workforce in general, right? You may have a few, and I think maybe law firms, I hate to pick on them, but they're a good example. And let's talk about leadership, right? You might have, I think it's 1% of partners across the country. And we're talking thousands and thousands of thousands of partners. So 1% are of color. And the number is barely, it's either right under 1% or right under 2% for that number that is women of color, Black women to be specific. So you know, representation is important because in that field, for example, the pipeline is really crucial, you know, establishing relationships or partnerships with a higher up mentor, you know, that person gives you assignments, that person checks in, that person may invite you, you know, to the golf course or, you know, all of the different places where decision making is happening and relationships are being developed outside. And if you have so little representation, it's not impossible, but the chances of really growing the circle or the net and having it be reflective of our society that we live in, those chances are lower substantially. So, you know, I just raised that example because when I decided to go to law school, you know, there were about 3% attorneys of color. And that was back in early 2000s. And unfortunately, that number really hasn't changed in the last two decades. So that's just one area where, you know, it's a specialized area, but it is one that even though opportunity has expanded, the numbers and the growth, especially in leadership, have been just terribly low in terms of diversity and representation.
Yeah, and I think we have to use examples to call out the issues. I think we can't speak broadly, although, you know, we can use the examples to highlight the broader issues. Thank you for sharing. And, you know, I would love to, like, pick apart every single industry, but we don't have the time.
Right. And again, we welcome people to do those Google searches. There's so much of this information that's readily available. It is. And I love that right now we're in a time where people are interested, and unfortunately at home, or, you know, hopefully too many people haven't lost their jobs, but, you know, people have that extra time that they're not commuting to, you know, instead of maybe watching so much of the news feed, really kind of dig in and see what the data has shown for so many of these issues that are kind of top of the mind right now.
Yeah. So I know that you and I talked a little bit about management. So not necessarily like board leadership or the C-suite leadership, but looking at, you know, the middle management or even upper middle management and kind of what the systemic norms and all of that does to not only representation, but then the people that are represented, what happens to them there. So I don't know if you want to.
Sure. I think I was referring to maybe something that I've seen is how systems of support change or are impacted based on leadership. So in industries that I've worked in nonprofits, for example, it's pretty glaring, in my opinion, that although it's a service industry that is dedicated to opportunity and definitely committed to marginalized communities, oftentimes when you look at the staffing in those areas, in nonprofits especially, you might see that there's not a lot of diversity, right? And then if there is, unfortunately, you might see people of color at the very entry or lower level jobs only. And I think that's a major problem, especially in a field like that, where the commitment is supposed to be to opportunity and expanding opportunity. And if that's your true commitment, I definitely believe that that should start at home, right? As you know, I think Americans say that about a lot of things, checking your own backyard, right? So as we're having these conversations, as we're seeing so much transformation and people want to help, people want to donate, and people want to give their money and time to causes that are really committed to and have been for a long time committed to social justice and racial justice, I challenge them to look into the makeup of these companies, you know, and it's not to say that we don't ever give to them, but I do encourage them to seek out Black-led companies. A lot of them are smaller they need support, and they do the work in a different way. And you can also support those other organizations, but please ask questions and challenge them on those practices. Like I said, I am really passionate about the workforce because that is our everyday, right? Unfortunately, we know that people spend more time with their work colleagues than their families. That's changing. It's a good and bad thing because we have this little thing called a pandemic. So people are actually seeing their families a little more. But, you know, in our normal scheme of things, we are spending a lot of time at work, and that extends into our mental health, right? So we should not be in a situation where we have, you know, a large group of people based on race many times that are just subject to a totally different standard of living and working due to racial trauma and maybe not getting the supports that they need, maybe not being provided the opportunity. And that, and oftentimes I just do want to make clear that it's because of a system and the structures that are in place. So it's not even always that we're saying we don't want to help these Black people or we don't want to see them succeed. But when you open doors, you do have to make sure that the pipeline is there, that the supports are there, and that they are treated like any other worker. And I think we have a lot of work to do in that department.
Yeah, I think we've unpacked a little bit of the work that we need to do. I thank you for bringing up the mental health piece. I want to make sure that we tie this in really strongly. So what do you think somebody would feel like if they were told their hair is not acceptable? What do you think that poor young man threw on the wrestling mat, right? Mm-hmm. These are really, really important considerations when we ask people to not show up as we or to not be their authentic selves.
Yeah. And that's another kind of maybe fascinating, maybe sad aspect to the time that we're in right now. I think it's becoming more apparent to more people just how normal this really abnormal what an abnormal existence a lot of people of color are living in this society, where you have to mask who you are in order to maybe make a living, in order to, what we've seen recently, you know, walk down the street trying not to be a threat to other people. You know, go into a store, you know, you can't play your music a certain way. Just a lot of the normal things in society where someone may live differently and show up differently, you know, that's traumatic, right? There's no other way to say it. I think oftentimes, and for many years, centuries even, we've been made to think that a lot of those facts about our society are normal. And so I love the conversation that's happening, and I love the corporate leadership that we're seeing. And I hope that it translates into, you know, policy changes within. But, you know, just the recognition that Black Americans are living a different existence, and it shouldn't be. And we thought we moved past this, and, you know, it's not like we have the segregated, you know, signs, you know, for colored only or anything like that right now. But unfortunately, our society is still segregated in many ways. You know, in Baltimore, for example, we just saw an incident that happened at a restaurant where there was a dress code and it was enforced. And these are children that were the issue here. But there was, you know, there was a dress code that was enforced for a Black little boy and not for the white family. And so, you know, I think a conversation like this is critical. That's why I actually wanted to volunteer my time to just have this conversation and, you know, talk about how it impacts me, because, you know, I have been in a situation where I have felt like I was under undue stress, inappropriate stress. And I decided that that was not normal. That was not something I was willing to put up with, and that I had to change my environment because of it. And, you know, unfortunately, that's not fair. And that's not something that a lot of people should have to do. But these are decisions that are made a lot of times, and they certainly can impact your mental health. And I would also encourage people to be thinking about that, both those who have experienced something traumatic related to race and those who are in an environment where, you know, they may see something and maybe look the other way. You know, it's easy in our society to say, that's not my business, or I can't do anything about it. But, you know, you would be amazed at what just a simple acknowledgement, a look, a question, a polite question might change, you know, the impact that that might have. And I think that those are all the steps that, you know, we can all individually take. And it's even more important for those of us that are in leadership as we really work to change systems.
Wow. So much good stuff there. So thank you for bringing up the restaurant, because I didn't even connect that with our conversation that we were planning on having today. I did see, not that this really excuses anything, that they hired the two managers and they're redoing or throwing out the dress code. That's too little too late, but it's good.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, it's, I don't even know what to say. You know, there'd be varying opinions about whether or not it's enough action or, you know, too much, you know, somebody's livelihood impacted, but, you know, this impacts Black people's livelihood every day. Like, racism is not a small thing. And so when people see the repercussions and they have sympathy, or they, you know, they immediately say, oh, that's not fair. Like, it's not fair for people to be subject to that, to these indignities, right, in their daily life. Some, you know, we should just take as much seriousness when we are dealing with a response to a bad behavior. You know, we should think about that bad behavior just as seriously, because it does have long-standing impacts in most cases.
So we only have a couple more minutes left, so I want to make sure that you do have the, like, recommendations piece. And I know we've been spelling it throughout, so... So you mentioned having mentors. You mentioned having mentors available for people of color. Is that what you were intending there? Yeah.
Yeah. So just to circle back, like, we started the conversation with the idea of pay equity, people of color in the workplace. And there are a number of tools, I would say, that are very useful. I think it's important to not only just have a chief diversity officer, but to really establish what your mission and your goals are with regards to representation, diversity, and inclusion in your work setting. That has to be done, and it has to be incorporated into every part of your organization, because it is an issue that will come up in every aspect of the organization. It's just inevitable, right? So oftentimes we may see companies, they just have that one person, and it's really difficult to change norms. You know, these are so intrinsic, they're decades in the making. And so we shouldn't leave that on one person. So I definitely recommend review of policies and an actual committee when you want to make changes in that arena. That's where I would start.
Okay. So committees are great and also not great sometimes. But you have multiple people to share the load, which is important. Mm-hmm. Come down to one person making huge decisions on race, ethnicity, et cetera, especially because we don't have one ethnicity in the department. Yeah. So it should be a fair representation, as we've been saying, of, you know, hopefully the general population, but certainly the population of the workplace.
Yes. And I will say that, you know, committees, you can have levels of success, but at least a lot of times you can at least have buy-in from others. I think the actual CEO or manager really making decisions about policies would be more likely to listen. And hopefully if they have made the move to, or, you know, are moving in the direction to address some of these issues that we see, hopefully they will actually be respectful of those committee members and try to be responsive. We know that it's hard, and we've seen that fail, I think, in some cases, but I am one who believes you just have to keep trying till you get it right. So
yeah, that's great and inspirational. I'll rethink my videos, having been a member of a couple that had lower levels of success, as we gently said. And I also really liked your idea about using the committee for like interviewing and screening. And I think it's funny because one of the driest interviews I've ever had in my entire life was for a government position. And it's like, there's like six people in this room. They're all staring at me. They have exactly 10 questions and nothing else. And I was like, this is the weirdest interview that I've ever been in. Like, there's no human connection. Like, nobody smiled at me. And that might've just been indicative of that government.
Yeah.
Interviewed for. But I was like, wow, government, I don't know about this style. But I thought about how it was probably meant to even the playing field, or that there wasn't any sort of preference, but it was a very strange experience on my end.
That sounds strange. Yeah. I mean, I'm sure part of that is just, you know, people not paying attention, right?
You know. That's okay. I won't take offense. I didn't really want the job anyway, but, you know, I was like, oh, the government, you know.
And I will say this. I think it's important, no matter what industry or what field, to bring your humanity, right? And ultimately, when we talk about conversations about diversity and inclusion, that's essentially what we want. We're not robots. And so I'm sorry, I actually have been on committees. And I do think it's important to make people feel comfortable. So yeah, that sounds like a horrible experience. And I would not want any committee that I'm a part of to engage like that. But you know, people are busy, you know, they take their time to engage, and it goes, you know,
no,
it's
just a strange experience. Not all of the government interviews are like this, or even at this branch.
Right. But I mean, that's a good point, though, because it does, just want to say, culture is so important. And it shows up in many different ways, right? And so who knows what was going on in that team? You know, what kind of personal issue one may, you know, somebody may have just been cursed out the time before, you know, so they were a little on edge. But I also like to remind people that a lot of times those types of issues really don't have anything to do with them personally. It's really definitely a reflection of the culture.
And I left that interview going, I don't see myself fitting in here just because I'm like, I'm loud and
fun.
A laugh and stuff. And I was like, nobody even smiled. I don't think I can work somewhere where people don't smile. So it's just funny. I don't want to derail us too far here. Committees, being really mindful of the interviewing process. I've seen some interesting theories put forth based off of that study you mentioned before, saying that we should just remove names from resumes and just let, you know, resume stand for itself. Of course, it's tricky when you get to the, like, you know, to know somebody's name at some point part.
Yeah.
That was interesting.
Can't say that I've heard about that one, but it is interesting.
Yeah. So the idea is that they would put like candidate A or candidate 100,
yeah,
whatever, and then you'd look at it from the computer because you sat there and typed boxes in, and then you get it up and you're like, oh, candidate 113, you know, excellent. So we're moving them on to the next stage, and then they're flagged as somebody to call for an interview. And so there's less of the bias available based on names, whether familiarity or issues or whatever is going on there.
Right.
Had so many good bystander tips that I would love to kind of rehash them if you don't mind. So giving somebody a look could be really helpful. And I wasn't sure if you meant to the perpetrator or to the experiencing the issue or both.
Yeah. And so I will just kind of give a disclaimer that I am not like a professional in this, right? I mean, I'm a professional in diversity and equity, but not necessarily in intervention. And sometimes these are very tricky situations, right? Mm-hmm. So I'll just say people should definitely use their best judgment, but there is evidence and there is a such thing as like bystander training and intervention when you're dealing with race. So that's definitely something people should look up and do more research on, because I will say though, whether it's in a meeting, we talked a little bit about representation and how it shows up, and we didn't really talk about the daily interactions in the workplace. You know, sometimes people may make inappropriate jokes. Sometimes it may be about race or any other inappropriate thing. And oftentimes people just kind of laugh it off, even when they know it's wrong or when it may rub someone the wrong way. And that's an opportunity where people can say, hey, or, you know, they can tailor it to their own personality. But I think the important thing is that you say something or give the person a look or a nod or tell them to come back to your office. There's so many ways that we can just show up for each other because, and I think this is kind of just a general kind of reminder about the workplace and culture and even mental health. You know, we know that isolation is very unhealthy and damaging, right? So when we give someone the look and when we show that something was inappropriate or that we see you, we acknowledge you, your feedback, that really makes a difference in inclusion. So that's just, you know, one point. I did want to mention, and I'm not sure this, if, you know, I know we're kind of short on time, but I think another way that we can be very intentional about how we are engaging, even right now, and I want to say, I'm going to be very respectful, but when we have conversations about race, I think a lot of times we are not being as considerate, and this is the, maybe, I don't know if that's too strong of a word, but this is generally whether you, I know that people were reaching out to their friends of color, people were doing a lot of things to try to understand, but that it's an emotional toll, right? And so there are a number of ways that we are including people of color, but we also need to really be aware of that additional kind of tax on people of color as they talk about some of these things. I know that for me, you know, I was a sociology major. So, you know, I love talking about this stuff. I could go on for hours. I know we don't have that much time, but, you know, people should be, you know, compensated in certain instances where we think it's appropriate or where it's situations where we might compensate other experts, you know, because this is a time where we're living out something that not everyone can talk about. And so people of color have a certain expertise. And when we think about how we treat Black professionals, often we don't treat them the same. And that, you know, that's just kind of unfortunately the fact. So there are times where we could be maybe more creative about how we are inviting people of color to a space to talk about something that can be very traumatic and very personal. So that's just one side note I did want to throw out there because there's a lot of conversation about that, to be frank. And I am a person that believes in transparency. And I do want, you know, I want people to be aware of just that some of the dynamics, a lot of the dynamics that we are not always privy to. Sometimes we don't feel comfortable. People of color may not feel comfortable talking about it, but I do think it's very important to the conversation, especially at a time like now.
Thank you. Emotional labor is something we've talked about on the podcast before. We will be talking about in this Black Mental Health Matters series. We're talking about racial battle fatigue. We're talking about the history of racial trauma. So we do have, if you're listening now, I hope that you listen to the full series of this and that you make any recommendations. If you think there's other topics we should explore, totally open to finding the right person to come talk to us about this. So I really appreciate, again, your time, Kimberly. It's been really lovely to chat with you about all of the different things. We went way into hair, which I was not expecting, but it was really fun to talk about and just examine how something that seems really simple, like I brush my hair every day and I just go on with my life. It's just something that I really don't think about as much. And so I think it's just a weird way that we can look at the systemic issues that kind of evolve.
Yeah.
So I always end my episodes with a self-care send-off. Do you have a self-care tip that you would like to share with our listeners?
So many. I'll share probably a pretty basic one, but I think it's so critical. And that is meditation. It's very important that people take the time. Our days can be pretty hectic and it's a little different right now while most of us are at home, but we are getting ready to ease back into the normal way of being, I suppose. We'll see what those numbers continue to look like as far as hospital stays and COVID testing. But I would say people, all backgrounds, no matter your job, even if you're a stay-at-home mom, find that time to just collect your thoughts, you know, not think about your to-do list and really kind of set the stage for how you want your day to be. And I guarantee that you will be so appreciative of yourself for making that time for yourself.
Thank you. That's a great tip. If you have literally never done meditation before, I always recommend Headspace as a free app to just get started. And you can say, I have 2 minutes a day. And I promise you have 2 minutes a day. I promise.
Then there's exactly 2 minutes is enough. You know, it's pretty amazing. We take time. I've heard people describe it as we take time to care for so many things, but never just for our mental health state. It's like pretty crazy. We go through all of our lives. Like, I didn't start till, you know, I'm over 30 years of, I'm not going to say my age, of course, but, you know, over 30 years of not taking that time, and it has changed my life.
Hmm. Yeah, I think that schools don't often teach, and parents weren't taught. And so you make mid-20s, and something I do like about the internet for all of the, I mean, many things about the internet, but what I especially like about the internet is it opens up this vulnerability that people can share with each other. To be clear, Kimberly and I do not know each other. This is the first time we met. And so this is just, it's just a fascinating tool to be able to learn, to diversify what you are learning from. You don't get stuck only looking at one news channel. You don't read books by one type of author, et cetera. You're always working to broaden your view. And so that's going to be my self-care tip, I think, for today, is to continue to broaden your view and learn people that are different from you in all aspects and see what you learn in that way. So I think that concludes our episode for today. Thank you again, Kimberly, so much for, you know, coming and talking to us. You've been a delight. We are wishing you good mental health.
Thank you so much for having me. Have a great day.
Connect with us. We are Dragon Digital Radio.